Thanks for being with us for another edition of the Student Press Law Center podcast. The Student Press Law Center is an advocate for free expression and transparency in schools and colleges, and we train student journalists to use the law to gather and report great stories, just like the stories that we are here today to talk about. If you're interested in learning more, we hope you'll visit the splc.org website and consider becoming a supporter of the First Amendment's best friend on campus. I'm Frank Lomani, Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center, and we are here to talk to two Ohio journalists whose reporting exposed the mistreatment of students in public schools and led to some ongoing state-level reforms. With us are Jennifer Smith-Richards, education reporter from the Columbus Dispatch, and Molly Bloom, a reporter with State Impact Ohio, a project of NPR and Ohio Public Media, which she'll tell us a little bit more about. The two of them collaborated on a series of stories published last summer and fall titled Locked Away, the results of a joint investigation into the use of so-called seclusion rooms in schools in Columbus, Ohio, and elsewhere. Their reporting disclosed the widespread use of rooms not much bigger than closets to confine special needs kids when they become unruly, a practice that's both questionable legally and as a matter of safety. In January of this year, the State Board of Education responded with some new guidelines governing the use of these seclusion rooms and restraints, and we'll talk about the series, about the response it received, and about the difficulty journalists encounter in reporting on sensitive subjects in schools. So, Jennifer Smith-Richards and Molly Bloom, thanks so much for being with us on the podcast. And Molly Bloom, can we just start with you explaining a bit more about what State Impact Ohio is and what you do there?
Sure. State Impact Ohio is a collaboration between NPR and Ohio Public Radio. We are one of eight state impact projects throughout the country, and each state is focused on looking at the effect of state policy decisions on people's lives. So here in Ohio, we focus exclusively on education. Our stories air on Ohio Public Radio stations and on NPR, and also on the State Impact Ohio website.
Well, Jennifer Smith-Richards, why don't you get us started? Just walk us through how this story got started. How did you get the idea that there might be a problem with the utilization of these restraining rooms, and how did you proceed from that initial piece of information to confirm what you suspected?
The project was actually born out of breaking news stories here in Columbus, where it was discovered that a couple of young boys had been abused inside a seclusion room. In a Columbus City school. Molly and I started writing a little bit about that separately and then started asking sort of to one another, where are seclusion rooms? What are these rooms and where are they located and how often are they used? And we pretty quickly realized that no one really knew. The state had never really surveyed schools to find out if they had seclusion rooms, how often they used them, why they used them, and so forth. And I think we saw an opportunity there to reach out and find some answers. So we sort of decided to join forces and do a sort of quick survey of 100 school districts in Ohio. Ohio has a little more than 600 school districts, so it was a quite small sample. But we did a survey of 100 school districts and sent out public records requests to try to determine if we could, see if we could figure out where the rooms were and how often they were being used and so forth.
Mm-hmm. So you have this information based on a couple of known instances of misuse of these seclusion rooms, and you're trying to confirm your suspicions that this may be more of a widespread problem than just a handful of isolated instances. So I guess, Molly, can you kind of pick up the story from there? How do you go about and keeping in mind that the folks listening are going to be reporters for the most part, how do you go about broadening out the story from a handful of isolated instances to questioning in a more systemic way how these restraining type techniques are used?
Yeah, so like Jennifer said, we'd heard all these reports and, you hear calls from parents and advocates about them, but no one really seemed to know what exactly was happening. So we looked at public records requests mostly as a tool to find out what exactly is happening. Is this a problem? Is it not a problem? So we I think what we did was we focused on what were the questions we wanted to answer about the use of seclusion rooms in schools, and then we drafted a public records request. We sort of worked together to make sure it covered the bases that we sent out via email to, like Jennifer said, about 100 schools, and including charter schools and districts. And we used the state's educational directory to just pull all the emails for the superintendents or the people in charge of those schools. So it wasn't like we were doing this by hand. We merged everything together. Each one of the reporters took about a third of the list, and we sent out the public records requests and a little follow-up, and started getting some responses back.
So I'm guessing that this was not a completely friction-free process, Jennifer. Can you describe a little bit about maybe some of the obstacles that you ran into? You're requesting records about pretty sensitive stuff here. You've got young students, you've got minors involved, you've got special needs kids involved, and of course you've got discipline involved, all things that schools are sensitive about talking about.
Right. To say that districts were reluctant would be, you know, a horrible understatement. They didn't want to talk about it at all. So we encountered actually a lot of school districts that simply did not respond. We had some school districts that immediately responded and said, this is private. This is protected by FERPA, the federal student privacy law. We had some districts that responded and said, why do you want to know? Which, of course, we didn't have to tell them. But
right.
I think that we took an approach from the beginning of trying to make this almost less scary for the districts. You know, we were asking questions. We were polite. We really worked hard to try to explain that we were just trying to gather some information that we felt was public and the public had a right to know. So I think we had a great deal of success with most of the districts. And in the end, I think we got an answer back from almost everyone.
I think one of the things that was helpful for me with some of my districts was pointing out that we're asking 99 other districts the same set of questions. We're not singling you out for any reason. You know, most of them have responded. Here's what they said. You know, can you be just like them?
So you get these responses back, Molly, and after some level of back-and-forth negotiation, you're able to get what you think is a meaningful amount of data back. How do you go from there to conclude whether or not the use of restraints and seclusion is or is not appropriate or authorized? What sources do you use? What methods do you use?
So as the responses came back in, Jennifer, Ida Liuskowski, and I tracked them in a Google Doc in a spreadsheet, and we had columns for each type of record we were asking for. Did the schools have policies? Did they keep logs of how the rooms were used? Did they notify parents? So as they came in, we were able to keep track of that and quantify it to an extent for the districts we were looking at to get a sense of, like you said, if it was a problem. And in addition to that tracking of responses, in the meanwhile, we were talking to a whole bunch of different kinds of educators and researchers and people who work with children with special needs to understand what the research says about the use of seclusion and restraint, to answer questions like, are there reasons to use it? Does it hurt children? You know, what are the reasons to use it? What are the reasons not to use it? So that we can understand the information we're getting back from school districts.
Right. And so I guess for people who haven't dealt with this area, is it ever a permissible thing under state and federal law? Is it ever a permissible thing that when you have a student who's being unruly or is acting out, that you just lock them in a room? Is that ever a permissible response?
So federal guidelines say that it is permissible in cases of, frankly, very extreme cases where a child is a physical danger to himself or to others, but that it's not to be used for convenience or as a punishment or really for any other reason. There is, I think, widespread agreement that these are not supposed to be often used, and they are not supposed to be a first resort for a frustrated teacher.
And that was really the bottom line, I guess, of what you were able to conclude through the combination of public records and interviews, is that there was at least some substantial evidence that there were schools that were using these little closet-sized rooms more as a tool of discipline and punishment than as a tool of physical control. They were using them when it was not really necessary for the safety of other students, but more as a tool of behavior modification. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, that was pretty clear. When we got some of the logs back from schools, and we didn't get them from every district, like we said earlier, some of the districts denied that request under FERPA, and we were not able to successfully fight that in the time that we had. But for some of the districts that did provide us with logs that explained how long a student was in a seclusion room and typically some sort of explanation as to why, we could pretty quickly see that the reasons had nothing to do with violence. And that took, frankly, a fair amount of time and investment on our part to read through stacks of logs that explained students' experiences in seclusion.
Well, and Jennifer, we were talking about this a little earlier. Maybe you can elaborate on this. I mean, one of the difficulties in compiling meaningful data on something like this is that you're sometimes dealing with schools that themselves have never asked this question, right? How often do we do this on an annual basis? And they've never actually done the math themselves, right?
For a long time, we did not know how many seclusion rooms were in Columbus City Schools, and that is Ohio's largest school district. They did not know. We kept getting a different count, and over several months, it took them quite a long time to identify throughout their 116 schools where seclusion rooms were and which ones were actually in use. So what we found is many school districts did not keep any sort of aggregate data. They didn't know how often rooms were being used. They did not know generally why. They did not know generally how long, you know, even on average, students were kept in the rooms. So that was something that we had to sort of parse through and look at the data ourselves to try to come to some sort of determination.
So Molly, take us forward to you published the initial round of stories in August. What sort of reaction ensues from the public, from the advocate community, and from the regulators?
So when we spoke with the Ohio Department of Education when we were writing the stories, there was a task force underway that had been underway before and had gone through some permutations. But this task force was putting together, you know, a draft policy that they could use to potentially regulate the use of seclusion rooms in schools. After the story ran, there was definitely some response, and the board began to move fairly quickly to actually put that policy in place. When they put it out for public comment, I think they got, you know, over 100 comments, I think, at least, if not more, from parents, from educators, from, you know, researchers, all kinds of people who obviously, you know, felt really strongly about how the room should be used and how they should be regulated. So it seemed to be something that struck a chord with a lot of people.
Really interesting. And Molly, were there people on the other side coming forward and saying, look, you don't understand how hard this is to be a teacher, and sometimes this is my only choice? Was there a lot of pushback on the other side?
There was definitely pushback from school administrators and teachers and parents, too, who said these rooms can be a useful tool, that if my child acts out and is running out of the classroom or is throwing things in the classroom, and maybe the school's only alternative is to send the child home for the day. And so being able to send them to a room where they can, you know, calm down, where they can potentially learn to calm themselves down, and then go back to the classroom is a better outcome than sending the kid home or calling the cops. Because sometimes these children can be really challenging to teach and to have in a school. So there were definitely people who thought we don't want to rule out seclusion rooms as a tool.
Right. So did anything in your reporting, Jennifer, give you any reason to think that Ohio or Columbus was in any way special or unique here? Or is it your suspicion that if a person were to investigate this story in Orlando or Dallas or St. Louis or anywhere else, they might find comparable statistics?
Research that's out there indicates that this is a problem in other places, too. This is a topic of interest in other places. The federal government has started to examine this in greater detail and has put out guidelines in recent years. And one has to think that if the federal government is stepping in and putting out guidelines, it is not an Ohio-specific issue. This clearly is something that reporters could could go after in their state.
So in addition to the initial response from the public and the comments that you received and the comments that the state began receiving, there was a vote in January earlier this month by the state board of ed that actually put some guidelines and some new reporting requirements. And Molly, can you tell us a little bit about what they decided?
What they put in place was a policy, and they started to put in motion the process to develop actual state administrative code rules.
Mm-hmm.
The policy says seclusion and restraint can only be used in emergencies. It says the Department of Education may monitor their use, and it sets out how confidential records relating to the use of seclusion rooms are.
So one of the criticisms that has been raised about the state board's reaction, and Jennifer, your paper has reported on this, is it's not at all clear that the statistics that are gathered about the use of seclusion rooms are going to clearly be made available to the public. There's some lack of clarity about whether the reports compiled by the Department of Ed on this subject are actually going to be accessible to the public, correct?
Right. In some regards, the language of the policy itself is a little bit unclear. It does say that districts will be required to keep some sort of aggregate data, but isn't exactly specific on what the aggregate data should include. Specifically, it doesn't say that districts must record why children were secluded. And then it says that the Ohio Department of Education may ask for this data annually, but it does not require the department to do so. It lists a little requirement about confidentiality as part of the policy that says that the logs themselves and information about students' experience in seclusion will be protected by FERPA.
Right.
At one time, the policy actually said it will be confidential, and I think that enough protest occurred that that particular word was removed. But it still remains that most of the information, it seems, will be considered protected by FERPA.
Well, in the few minutes that we have left, let me give each of you a chance, starting with Molly, to just kind of lay out for folks out there. Let's say there's a reporter who believes that there may be an excessive use of student restraints going on in their school district. They are trying to embark on an investigation like this in their community. Any kind of takeaways or lessons learned from your experience that if you were doing it over again today would make the work more effective and more efficient?
Yeah, certainly. I could think of a number of things that we could have done better. I guess, first of all, was looking at it's really important to be both organized and persistent, especially if you're focusing on, you know, more than one school or more than one school district. You want to track the requests that you've sent out and the responses that you've had coming back in, and the communications that you've had with each district. And I'm sure, you know, most of your listeners know this, but the importance of being persistent and making follow-up calls and emails and documenting that to make sure they know that you're not going to go away.
Right.
So that was definitely a key lesson for us.
Right. Jennifer, any thoughts on that?
Sure. So one of the things that we ran up against was, frankly, a not perfectly worded public records request. The beauty of a public records request is that you're asking for records. And I think that we were trying to get at the answer to a question. I'll give you the specific. We wanted to know if school districts had seclusion rooms. We were trying to get that answer. And the way we were trying to answer that through a records request was we asked districts to tell us the locations of their seclusion rooms, to give us records that show the locations of their seclusion rooms. And many of them didn't have that. They didn't have some sort of map that showed the locations. And so we had to often go back to the district and say, listen, what we really want to know is, do you have seclusion rooms? So probably if we had crafted the request a little more carefully in the beginning, it might have sort of lessened the legwork a little. The other thing is, I would be prepared to really understand FERPA well before you even send anything out. You know what a student record is, know what types of records really are private, and be prepared to argue against privacy when it's not appropriate. In many cases, the logs that we received with a simple redaction of a name we never could have traced the information about that child back to an individual child. It wouldn't have been considered personally identifiable information. And once we started seeing those logs come in, we were able to make that case to other districts and say, listen, if you simply redact the name, this is a record that will be perfectly fine to release under FERPA.
Well, Molly, just take one second, if you would, because I think this is really fascinating that this was a joint project basically between a broadcast news operation and a print news operation, and we're seeing more and more people do these in a collaborative way, people who maybe in an earlier age used to consider each other competitors. What were the advantages of working in a collaborative way this way? And I should mention you had a third partner with you at State Impact, Ida Liskovsky, who split up a lot of the document and legwork with you and was equally responsible for this project. What was the benefit of this collaborative arrangement?
I think one of the big benefits of doing this as a collaboration was that we were able to cover the entire state. Certainly, Jennifer could have sent out 100 public records requests on her own. Ida and I could have done the same thing, but it would have taken a lot longer. And you also, I think we each bring different strengths to this project. Jennifer obviously has a strong background in terms of investigative reporting. Ida is a broadcast reporter, so she has a knack for getting good stories out of people that get at the heart and the emotion of the issues we're covering. So we are able to marry those skills together to produce a series of pieces that reach different audiences both on air, online, and in the paper that was just wider than any of us could have done on our own.
Well, I really want to thank the both of you, Jennifer Smith-Richards and Molly Bloom, and I want to thank your colleague, Ida Liskovsky, who couldn't be with us today but who was a co-participant in this project, for sharing your tips about reporting on sensitive subjects in schools and for doing some really, really great investigative work on an important subject that is not widely understood. You can check out the work that these reporters have done at dispatch.com and also at stateimpact.npr.org/Ohio. We hope that you will check out all the resources that are available on the SPLC website as well. That's www.splc.org. And if you're a reporter who's doing great public records journalism about schools and colleges, we hope you'll share your story on the SPLC's Tumblr site. If you're a student journalist or a journalism educator with any question about the law, our hotline is always available, 703-807-1904, or by email at splc@splc.org. Thanks for listening.